ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is one of those great big gigantic family stories today. I'm with Jane Messer. Jane is an author. She grew up in Australia in a nice suburb with a loving father. But Jane always knew her dad had been wounded by his childhood. Jane's dad, Michael, had been born in Berlin. This is Berlin in the wild years between the two world wars. The family had been well-to-do. There was plenty of theatre, movies, dinners, laughter and wild parties. But when Jane's dad was 8 years old, his mother, Bella, brought him and his older sister to England to a boarding school. And then she left them there. There were a few fleeting visits, but Jane's dad didn't see his mother again for another 13 years. Michael always called Bella die Rabenmutter, a raven mother, which is an old German expression for a mother who cruelly abandons her children. He always told Jane, she never loved me. Jane never knew her grandmother Bella, so she didn't really have anything to go on. But as Jane grew older and had kids of her own, she knew that there had to be so much more to Bella's story. And so Jane went on the trail of her grandmother, Bella, from pre-war Berlin to Tel Aviv to Melbourne, to try to understand the choices that Bella made in extraordinary circumstances. Jane Messer's book is called Raven Mother. Hello, Jane.
Hello, Richard.
Extraordinary book. Let's start with you and your dad, Michael. How old is Michael now?
He's 99. He turned 99 a couple of weeks ago.
How close have you been with your dad from childhood?
I think we've always had a close relationship. I'm the eldest. I've got two younger brothers. I think I've just always felt naturally close to him, though he's quite an eccentric person. He's sort of distant but warm at the same time. But what I do remember is lots of stories from Dad about his childhood. And they were fascinating stories. So in some ways, they were adventure stories.
And would he just put them in front of you or did you draw them down from him?
No, he would put them in front. We sat down at the table for dinner, for meals. Television was off and my parents did talk. And so my mother was part of these conversations, drawing him out. She was fascinated by his history. So when I was a kid, it was really perhaps them curating these stories. When I came later as very much as an adult, well into my, I guess, late 40s, I had lots of memories of these stories that I would go back and say, what about this? What did you mean when you said that? So I was incredibly fortunate to have been at the dinner table being told these stories.
And how would he talk about Bella, his mother?
Well, she was the bad mother. I mean, that's how he described her.
He did use that phrase, raven mother.
Well, no, that was a phrase I came across when I was living in Berlin. It was an old expression for mothers who abandoned their children, and it had become revived to describe women who use childcare. I mean, yeah, I know. Apparently popular in Sweden as well, where they have free childcare. So then I told Dad about this expression when he was talking about Bella, and then he said, yes, she was a Rabenmutter.
What was he told? What did he have in his mind was the reason why he'd been dumped in a boarding school in England with his sister Ruth?
Look, he knew that it was for their own safety. So he and his older sister Ruth, who was 5 years older, they were 8 and 13 when they arrived at Bunce Court in Kent in England, taken there by Bella. He didn't know the extent of the Third Reich or the Nazis, but he knew that they were there for their own good. So Ruth was a little bit more aware because she was older, but he was just 8 and he was quite a naive, you know. He describes himself as an immature child. I can see that it's probably true.
Oh, he's a little boy.
He's a little boy.
Was the problem then that Mum didn't come back to collect him? Is that what the problem was?
So my dad's memory is that they arrived there. He believed, from what she said, that they were there for a holiday for a few days. And then she said, goodbye, and I'll be back in a couple of days. And then she didn't come back. She did actually come back about 4 or 5 months later to visit and another couple of times. But they were brief visits. And for him, he just was like, she just left. She lied to me. She didn't tell me what was really going on. And then she went.
You detected quite a bit of underlying sadness. That was something you could pick up even as a kid.
Yeah.
Later you began to think that there was an underlying shame as well. Why shame?
Really, that word only came to me from writing the book. When you're excavating things as you're writing and you're trying to dig deeper, not just into facts but into memories and emotions and you're asking deep questions, I realised that I had carried or was still carrying this sort of sense of shame, and I think it was one from him of feeling unlovable. I mean, one time he said to me, oh, maybe I just wasn't a likable little boy. And I'm like, Dad, yes, you were. Of course you were. You were just a child like everybody else. And I could tell, I mean, this is the thing, after I started to pull out boxes of photographs and I discovered photos where she would hold him with such warmth and friendliness, and she was quite playful, and they weren't stiff pictures, very playful.
So you can see affection in those photos.
I could absolutely, and he was a playful child too.
But it's really common for kids when families break or there's some kind of disconnection to somehow see themselves as being responsible for this.
Absolutely.
I wasn't enough, I didn't do this, it was my fault, I did this. But you said you felt some of this shame. What do you mean? What are you talking about? You went there.
I do think if you're a reasonably empathic or sensitive person or child, sometimes you take on the feelings and experiences. And remember, I had all these stories, and through the writing I realised that I'd carried a shame that I was the child of somebody who hadn't been loved. And so that made me a bit unlovable too. None of it's rational, but, I mean, you have these feelings. I mean, I don't have this feeling now. Realising that kind of freed me from it, but it was a burden when I was growing up.
Did that thought, when it came into your head, really profoundly shock you, that you've been carrying this shame for nothing?
And it was mixed up. I mean, it was mixed up with so many other things, because it was also mixed up with being Jewish, you know, with this terrible history. You know, we had the history of the Third Reich on the bookshelf. So this was also my history. I mean, we just flooded with images of concentration camp victims naked and starving. And also because it was a secular household, I didn't have a robust religious culture to kind of respond to those images and metaphors of failure, if that makes sense, which I think would have been helpful.
When did you begin to suspect there might be more to your grandmother Bella's story than these bits and pieces you gleaned around the family table about her as a kid?
Well, a number of things all came together at a similar time. Firstly, I became a mother myself, and watching my daughter as a little girl and just realising that your narratives of your own childhood and what actually happened, there can be these sort of remarkable gaps. And the strength of my feeling for her, and also being with other mothers and young fathers, and just realising the passion that you can have. And so that made me think, Bella could have been different. My grandmother could have been different. And then there was also her daughter, my aunt Ruth, dying and saying no one had visited the grave. No one had ever visited Bella's grave. And thinking, hang on, why would that be? Why did neither her children or anyone go after she'd died in 1949? And then I became aware of this incredible history of mothers during war, and that mothers constantly have to make hard decisions to leave their child in a safe place but perhaps go somewhere else, or put their child on an unsafe boat in the hope that they'll have a future, because they won't have a future where they are now. Through my travels, I've met many mothers who go and work as domestic workers in foreign countries to send money home so that their children will be raised. So I started to have this understanding that Bella was different, was more complex than what my father knew of her.
How was your father when you told him you were going to follow her trail and look into her life and try and find out who she really was and draw up a bigger picture than the one your father had been able to give you?
He was really pleased. I mean,
he was?
Oh, yeah, because I was going to find out lots of things. It wasn't just about her, but also our relationship to Germany. He had always spoken German, but he had never been back. he had a very ambivalent relationship. I had a very ambivalent relationship to it. I didn't know what I was going to find out, so he wasn't ready to be critical of it yet.
He sent you a document he'd put together, which was a history of your family that was titled A History of My Family.
Yeah.
How much information was there?
It was incredibly useful. It was 10 pages. It was genealogical. This person was born here. They moved to this city at a certain date. So great-grandparents, I think it went back 3 or 4 generations. Most of it was facts, but there was some commentary. But in it, I realised what a grim family story it was. There'd just be like one line, like, my father's cousin Felix was taken off the street by the Berlin police for the race crime of having a relationship with a Gentile woman. My great uncle Felix had been taken off the street by the Berlin police and murdered in the police cell, and then I think was dumped on a footpath or something. A letter came 2 days later to Willie's cousin to say he could pick up his brother who was dead. Every third or fourth line, there was these incredible stories that we really didn't know anything about. Who were these people? What had happened? What was happening in Germany then?
So where did you go to pick up the trail of her life, to find out the broader life story of your grandmother, Bella?
Well, I went to Berlin twice. So I lived there twice in 2014 and then again in 2015.
So there's still family records in Berlin? I mean, this was a cratered out ruin at the end of the war.
Yeah, no. I had to use a genealogist for that, and there are a lot of missing records because of bombs and fires and so on. So you have pockets of excellent record keeping which survived the bombing, and then, yes, there's lots of missing records. I interviewed a few people who had known Dad and the milieu he'd been in when he came to Australia. And so I didn't meet anyone who'd met Bella in Australia or before, but people who are kind of adjacent.
So let's follow the life of your grandmother that was revealed to you on your search for her. She was born in Berlin, 1893, youngest of 5 children to Doris and Max. Family is Jewish, but how strongly did they identify as German?
They very much identified as German, and you can see it just in the names of the children. Bella Rosa, her sister was born Minna, but everybody knew her as Minnie. Another sister was called Charlotte. They made references to the Christian calendar.
They celebrated Christmas rather than Hanukkah, in other words.
I think they probably celebrated both. Dad remembers there was a certain level of religiosity, but not much. They didn't often go to synagogue. But that was kind of normal. That was very predominant. They valued the Jewish culture, but in their ordinary lives, going out in public, like many Jews, they just wanted to be German.
It's hard to explain, but this was nothing out of the ordinary for German Jewish people at that time, before the rise of Hitler, that you would find a whole lot of patriotic Jewish German people, many of whom served at the front in the First World War, won Iron Crosses for the defence of the fatherland, all that. This was quite unremarkable at that time for Jewish Germans to be very patriotically German.
Yeah, I mean, in the 1800s, there'd been a series of changes to the law which were more inclusive of German Jews. And so there was a lot of hope. There was also cynicism, and many Jews were aware that it probably wouldn't get very far. My grandfather was one of those. He says by the time he was 17, he knew that he would never be accepted as a German, just through all that casual, I guess what we call the casual racism that you encounter, as well as institutional blocks.
So Bella's family were quite well-to-do. What kind of an education did she get? Did she get a fairly liberal education by the standards of the day?
By the standards of the day, absolutely. There was this remarkable movement in education, this sort of big reform movement that Germany was leading in. So she went to Pestalozzi Froebel House and studied early childhood education, which today we would be thinking of in terms of like Steiner, Montessori.
Right, and when you're hearing that your grandmother was interested in the early education of small children, how did that factor into the story you'd heard that she was a kiddie hater?
Yeah, it just really threw me.
What did she do when World War I broke out?
Well, like many Germans and many German Jews, she volunteered. So she had the training in early childhood education. She then did 2 or 3 months nursing assistant training got on a train from Berlin, 800 kilometres to near the Baltic coast, to a town called Rorschach, which was in East Prussia. The Russians had invaded East Prussia very unexpectedly in August and September. Many children and families were injured, killed, orphaned, deported. So she was working with a group of children in a care home in Rorschach. Some, I think, were orphaned. Some were recovering from injuries.
And when you see the photos of her at that time, what does she look like with the kids?
Really relaxed, confident, very close, physically close. She often has her arms around them. Just seemed like a very warm person. Young woman. She was quite young. I mean, she was only 19 or 20. But
now, at some point, she was given a pendant for her services to the fatherland for looking after these children. And you wondered about this pendant. Tell me how you came to actually see it with your own eyes.
So my aunt, my dad's sister Ruth, her granddaughter Lisa, who was living at the time at Katoomba, said, oh, yeah, I've got a couple of bags or boxes of stuff from grandmother. Bella is Lisa's great-grandmother. So I took myself off up there and, yeah, there was some remarkable letters by Ruth and then this pendant in a beautiful box with velvet on a chain. It shows a woman in those sort of classical drapes, and it's clearly a pendant given to her for her service in World War One.
And what was it like to touch that and see it and hold it?
Very it was powerful. Precious. And it must have been precious to her. It obviously, because she kept, I mean, if you think of all the migrations that you're doing and you're packing bags and having to give things up, you don't give this up. You bring it with you. I was proud.
You're proud of her.
Yeah.
So after the war, Bella returns to Berlin. She worked in a school welfare board, again with kids. 1921, Bella gets married to your grandfather, Willie. Now, what were the interesting circumstances of that union?
Well, look, it turns out that Bella was pregnant and needed to get married.
Which was Willie. A couple of months in when they got married? A
couple of months in, yeah. So. Okay.
Then your dad's born in 1927. What are some of the earliest memories he has, he's able to tell you about his family life in interwar Berlin?
Yeah, he doesn't have many memories of his father because he manufactured caps and hats and he was a wholesaler. Willie's business was doing really well. So he was away a lot. He remembers that they had nannies because Bella was also working in the business. But he puts that down to her not wanting to see him. Who knows? Could be a combination of both. He remembers a birthday party or maybe a couple of birthday parties for him where everybody, the guests, they had lots of friends, would sing Mac the Knife.
Right, from Brecht's Threepenny Opera.
From the Threepenny Opera, which they would be obviously singing in German. And this was a big song in our childhood because then he could sing it in German, but he also had Louis Armstrong's version, which is just gorgeous because you've got a rich, gravelly voice, which kind of brings out all the scary, evil parts of the song.
When you see photos of your grandparents at this time, this is interwar Berlin. Yes, there's the hyperinflation, there's brown shirts, but there's also communists on the streets having fights. But this is Berlin really is the capital, cultural capital of the world probably at this point. This is the Berlin of exploding contemporary art, abstract expressionism, cabaret scene. This is like Berlin of the film Cabaret. Do you see photos of people, families, your family at the time kind of being part of that scene?
They definitely liked fancy dress parties. They would go out to dinner at nightclubs. They did lots of picnics out in fields and beaches, and it's kind of schizophrenic life because you have this increasing level of threat and disorder and precarity, those extremes of threat and pleasure, of gaiety and fear.
At some point, you discovered Bella began a long-term affair outside of her marriage. Now, when your father told you this had happened, just tell me exactly how he put Bella's inclinations in this area.
When Dad was about 80, he said to me, look, Jane, there's one more thing I have to tell you. I said, please tell me. He said, well, my mother was a nymphomaniac. And I just laughed. I mean, I was like, Dad, no. And he's like, looked at me and I said, that isn't even a thing. They don't even exist.
What did he mean? Does he mean like she supposedly liked sex or something? Like it was, and that's like some kind of psychiatric disorder?
Well, that she had sex with lots of men. And so then I was like, why do you think that? And he said, well, that's what Willie told me. And I said, well, maybe Willie was angry when he told you. And that's the sort of thing that an angry husband might say about their wife because they've had an affair or they've fallen in love with somebody else. And then we talked a bit about the history of the term.
The old trope that women surrender to their ungovernable sexual desires and all that thing.
Well, and Freud had kind of amplified it again. And in fact, you could accuse a woman of nymphomania in a way to get them put into an asylum or as a basis for divorce.
Yeah, men never get accused of nymphomania, though, do they?
No, they don't. So I was pretty angry with my grandfather about that because I think that's a pretty nasty thing to say. But look, he was born in 1892 and he grew up in a particular generation.
Man of his time.
Man of his time.
But when you're going through all this with your dad, did that help your dad? Did he follow your reasoning as you unpicked?
Yes. There was this really sweet kind of relief. I think he really did feel a burden had been taken off him. Because I could say, look, even if she had a few affairs, that's still in the range of normal. Like, that's what people do. Men and women do that. You know that.
So you've had two psychotic conditions thrown at you. One is that she's kind of psychopathically hostile to children. The second thing is she's a mad sex slave.
Gosh.
I hadn't really thought about it in such blunt terms,
yeah. But you're quite right.
Right. And it's clearly nowhere near as dramatic as that. Who was this man she was having an affair with, Walter Strauss?
He was a German professor of public health based in Berlin. That's where they met. He lost his job along with all the other Jewish university people in 1933 and a couple of years later was able to immigrate to the British Mandate of Palestine.
How were things in the marriage once your grandfather found out about this affair?
Not good.
Did she want to leave her husband for this man?
She did.
And what happened when that didn't happen?
She was suicidal. She was very, very distressed.
Did she attempt to take her own life?
Yes. Yeah, apparently.
You had a copy of Bella's address book. Tell me what you found in there.
So I was looking through the address book, wanting to find Walter Strauss's address just to know more about him. It wasn't there. And then I saw a little bit of a torn page. And the page had actually been torn out that would have had his address.
Who do you think tore it out?
I think it was probably her, but it might have been Willie, my grandfather, maybe in anger. It is remarkable. I was in Berlin when I discovered it and I was with Louis, my son, and I went into the other room where he was and I showed it to him. I just had to show it to somebody there and then.
So now we come to the year of 1933. This is the year Adolf Hitler gets made Chancellor of Germany and all hell starts to break loose. Your dad and your aunt are still living with their parents, Bella and Willie, in their nice home in Berlin, and they moved to a very well-to-do suburb called Charlottenburg. How long did they last in this place in Charlottenburg?
Only a couple of months, because the Third Reich's laws caused so many Jews to have to give up their jobs, not be able to sell their produce and so on. So having done quite well, the family started to do less well and then moved further west. And my grandfather was finding it harder and harder to run his business.
What was changing on the streets of Berlin for your family at that time?
More and more violence. I mean, street violence, black shirts or brown shirts attacking people, communists and Jews. My aunt remembers during the move being at a friend's house, you know, out of the way. She and her friend looked out the window and windows were being smashed. My grandfather's shop was, you know, the factory floor. Police came in and searched for things. I mean, it was just very, very violent and legally a lot is changing.
Tell me about your Aunt Ruth and what she did when she was abused in the street one day on her way to the bakery.
So she'd had to leave the normal school, the school she'd gone to, and go to a Jewish school. She became a little bit more religious and wanted to get the special bread for Friday. And on her walk to the bakery, she would have been 10 at this stage, and a girl called her a Jew and why don't you leave and go to Palestine, get away. And Ruth didn't say anything, thought about it, went and got the bread, but decided that if that happened again, she was going to do something about it. Sure enough, the next time the same girl is there, and Ruth actually slapped this girl's face. And she said, "That's how Jews can hit," to the girl. When I read this in my aunt's autobiography, I was so shocked. I think it's the only time anybody in the family has done anything like that, but good on her. But, I mean, it was a dangerous thing to do, Richard.
What was the school like that they were sent to?
The school, Bunce Court, it's quite famous in its own way, had clandestinely fled Germany in 1933 because of the changes to education and the general environment being so threatening.
Were they Quakers?
It was sponsored by the British Quakers. Anna Essinger was the school principal. She had studied with Quakers in America, so she received assistance from the British Quakers. They right. literally, in two buses, clandestinely left Germany in 1933, obviously with the parents' permission, with a number of German Jewish teachers. It was a secular school.
Right, so it's not that kind of boarding school thing no. you might get in your mind where boys are flogged in sort of cold showers and...
No. You called the teachers by their first name. There was no corporal punishment, partly because of the war and partly because of school philosophy. They grew their own vegetables, made furniture, had little orchestras, did lots of art, sport, field walks. There was also a rule they had to speak English for a number of reasons, partly because they were living in England, but also they didn't want to create suspicion amongst the locals.
More progressive than most schools today, in other words.
Oh, absolutely. And, right. I mean, that's why, look, so many people, including my father, left that school and went on and had remarkable lives because of the wonderful schooling and support. I mean, the teachers were very aware. I mean, people were losing their families, so it was an excellent school.
So this is 1935. Hitler's been in power for 2 years, but the Second World War isn't about to start for another 4 years or so. Your dad's 8 years old at this time, and you'd said earlier that when Bella had taken the two of them to this school, she said, "I'm coming back. It's all right, I'm going to come back and get you." But she didn't. She wasn't able to. But didn't your dad understand why he was put there? To put him and his sister out of reach of the Third Reich in England?
Look, if it was explained, he has no recollection. He just felt abandoned and lonely.
And he was eight.
He was eight, yeah.
1936. The temperature's getting hotter and things get worse. You write that back in Berlin, Bella's mother, Doris, your great-grandmother, took her own life. Now, can we assume this was in despair and terror of the Third Reich?
That is what I have concluded. I think she knew that all her family had either left, her children had either left or were trying to leave. It really wasn't possible for her to leave as a 78-year-old woman. No country would give her a visa. The highest rate of suicide amongst German Jews during those years was amongst older women because there was nowhere for them to go. With the Third Reich, there was a very big increase in suicides amongst German Jews, but also amongst other Germans who were being persecuted by the Third Reich.
Communists,
yeah.
Roma people or Sinti people right across the board. This was a real phenomenon. It's not often talked about. That feeling, that awful feeling that people had living in the lands controlled by the Third Reich, that the walls were closing in on them.
And look, there's this remarkable archive that the Berlin police kept and which wasn't lost in bombing. Every suicide was accompanied by a report. And so there is actually a remarkable archive that documents people's suicide notes. It's so much part of the culture. It's just constantly being referred to in the newspapers, in novels, in theatre.
Meanwhile, Bella and Willie were making plans to escape at last. Your dad had thought that his mother had just dumped him in England and never gone back to see him, but you found out she had been back several times. What was she actually doing on these repeated short trips back and forth between Berlin and England?
I think she was doing two things. My aunt writes about Bella sewing cash into her clothing and taking it out of the country, and she remembers her unpicking it in the train in London, presumably giving it to a friend or putting it into some safe place because Third Reich had huge taxes and you couldn't get money out if you were Jewish. And then she was also visiting the children, and my grandfather also visited one of those times.
So the plan was to escape, but at the time the United States, UK, Australia weren't really taking Jewish refugees at that time, trying to get out of the Third Reich. So they fetched up in Palestine, which was then being run under the British Mandate after the First World War. They got there in April 1937. But what about the kids? The kids are still in England, aren't they?
So the original plan was that they would immigrate to Palestine and make a new life there, hopefully, and that the children would finish their schooling. So Ruth was older. She actually joined her parents in early 1939. Dad being a bit younger, I guess they would have perhaps let him continue at the school, or if there was a good school to go to, they would have come and got him and he would have grown up in Palestine. My grandfather couldn't make a living or didn't like being there. Apparently he found the place too hot, or maybe it was to do with the marriage. Anyway, they applied to come to Australia because he did have capital and he had a business proposition that was something that was being sought after. The family did get approval to immigrate to Australia, but then there were problems with the administrative paperwork.
And trying to figure that out from Palestine.
Yeah.
It would have been tricky at the time because there's the war in North Africa going on after 1939 that's headed towards them there. Now, your father had always believed that Bella, his mother, had not gone to Palestine with her husband, Willie, but with her lover, Walter Strauss. That wasn't true at all, was it?
No. So a family relative had told Dad that Bella had sailed on the ship to Palestine with Walter Strauss, but Bella had come with Willie.
Your father thought that Bella had been partying with friends and lovers in Palestine during the war years. What had she actually been doing in Palestine during the war?
So in 1942, the Women's Auxiliary Territorial Service started to help protect Palestine and also to go to Egypt. The purpose of the ATS was to bring support to the men's army, build roads, drive trucks, move provisions, do communications. A lot of it was physically hard work. They were in the desert. It was quite grueling. They dug trenches. There's a photo of Bella lying beside one of the trenches that she and colleagues have dug.
This doesn't sound like she's drinking champagne in the King David Hotel, does it?
No.
So she's digging trenches instead.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess, you know, she had leave. You know, she'd come back to Tel Aviv on leave as other women did and see friends and catch up on sleep and enjoy sleeping in a bed.
Meanwhile, the years are rolling on here. Do you have any indication how she felt about being separated from her kids for so long?
We don't have a lot of clues, but there is a letter to Ruth where she's sort of looking forward to seeing Ruth and the family again, but says, perhaps you don't need me anymore. You're a mother, you're married, you've got your own interests.
So Ruth had grown up at that point and had her own child.
Yeah, Ruth had my cousin Lee and she'd married.
And Bella's saying, you don't need me.
In a way, yeah, the childhoods are gone. Her children grew up without her because of the war, because of the Holocaust.
Now, as part of this research experience, Jane, you wanted to experience something of the Palestinian experience. Your grandmother had been there for so many years, and she'd been there just before the State of Israel was founded and the Nakba, the expulsion of the Palestinians from their homes and their lands. Where could you go to find out about the Palestinian experience when you made your trip over to Israel?
So my third trip had become by then quite aware there was a very different history there for Palestinians as to what I'd been learning when I was focused on Bella and her Jewish experience. In that third visit in 2019, I spent time with volunteer groups. I sought out local Palestinians in Jaffa. I lived in Jaffa rather than in another area of Tel Aviv. I did a tour of the Gaza border. I went to Hebron. I tried to inform myself as much as I could. It wasn't something I've done before like that, so it was quite shocking, actually. I realised things for Palestinians were far worse than I even had known. I discovered there was this very effective erasure of Palestinian history, from whether it be missing street signs and villages that had been raised and built over where there was no acknowledgement of that past history, to the silence, just the silence. Because I met with quite a number of academics and Jewish academics, and they just never talked about it at all. It's like they're over there, they're somewhere else. And in a lot of ways they are invisible. They're behind very tall walls. And then at a certain point I realised that I really wanted to speak most to peace activists, whether they were Palestinian or Jewish, because there I would get the dual history and the dual experience that I was trying to make sense of. How can you have these two terrible histories of the Holocaust and the Nakba, and how do you bring them together in your mind chronologically and in place? So I made a connection with a volunteer organisation called Roads to Recovery. What it does is it has a volunteer driver who drive in their own car. They pick up a very ill Palestinian who needs high-level treatment. For instance, they might be sick with cancer or something like that, and drive them with one of their family members or a carer to a major Israeli hospital. So they're leaving the West Bank from one of the borders. So we had to get up very early, stayed the night at the volunteers. We drove for about an hour and a half. We get to one of the West Bank border gates. It's still very dark. There's these tall yellow lights. There's dust everywhere, vehicles, people. It's so chaotic. And I look at this sort of border where men, mainly men, are pouring out after having waited for hours to have their papers checked and so on. And then they're getting into trucks and cars and buses to go to work in Israel. And the volunteer that I was with, Avigdor, put up a long pole which had the Road to Recovery flag, because there was just so many people and it was dark. And at last they spotted us and we spotted them, and this elderly gentleman with a walking stick and his daughter come to us, and the gentleman gets in the car at the front with Avigdor and I get in the back with his daughter. And we drive for another hour and a half or so to one of the major hospitals. The sun comes up. We drive past the West Bank water wall, which, you know, has the barbed wire and it's so tall. And we weren't really talking much. I did have a little bit of a conversation. But then when we got to the hospital, that was when it really struck me, because I just got out. I could get out and I could just wander through the hospital grounds. But the carer, I'll just call her Ali, she had to go through a special area which was all glassed and be searched and have her papers checked and scanned and so on, like airport security basically. And it just seemed terribly wrong that I, as an Australian tourist, could just walk around freely and not be afraid. And she was in her own country and was being searched.
While you were there in Israel, was there anything left of your grandmother's Palestine? Was there any house you could go to that she had lived in?
There was. Early Bauhaus apartment in Circon Street, Tel Aviv. And, yeah, I walked there a few times and looked at it and could see the apartment that she'd lived in. The shrubbery was so old, like the plants, the stems were so thick, I realised they were the shrubs that would have been there when she was there. It wasn't particularly renovated. It was remarkable.
Eventually the family all reconvened in Melbourne bit by bit. In 1947, your dad arrived at long last, but by this time he was 20 years old. What kind of a career had he in mind for himself at this point?
He had already decided he wanted to be a scientist, and he'd done some study in biology, and he started at University of Melbourne and did honours there and went on to do a PhD. But when he arrived, he was just starting his studies.
And then a year later, Bella arrived in Melbourne, 1948. What was her arrival like? What was her reunion with her long-lost family like?
Look, I don't think it was happy at all. Her relationship with my grandfather was rock bottom. He was angry with her. He wouldn't go out with her. He had control of finances. My father was busy with uni and his friends. He didn't really pay any attention to her. He says he had a few conversations, but he was out a lot. Didn't feel any connection to her at that point. I think she had a closer relationship with my Aunt Ruth because of Lee, who was a little boy, who does actually remember meeting Bella. He was about six at that stage.
Was Bella living in the family home?
Yes, she was. So she was living in the apartment with my father and grandfather, but they had separate bedrooms. They weren't living as a married couple.
Was she able to make any kind of a life for herself in Melbourne?
No, there's no record of anything except for her saying that there's no point to me. I mean, she just said, I can't go out. You can't go out as a woman alone here. We have to imagine a very traditional society. Possibly the Jewish community wasn't welcoming, possibly because of the breakdown in the marriage. I think they're quite big cultural differences. German Jews from Berlin, they're very bourgeois, very educated. They're quite different from other Jewish communities. And like all communities, there's the cliques and the ins and outs. And it's something I'm still curious about those communities in those years. But she was not welcomed.
And then in 1949, she'd been in Australia for less than 2 years, Bella took her own life in Melbourne. How were you told that she'd suicided?
So for all Dad stories when we were young, I never knew that. I mean, he never mentioned how she died. I just knew she'd died a long time before I was born. But when I was in my early or mid-20s, I was at my parents' house and they were hovering around and they clearly wanted to tell me something important. And then Dad says, Jane, there's something I need you to know. And I'm like, you got to remember, I'm a glib 20-something-year-old. And I go, yeah, what? And he says, look, your grandmother, Bella, took her own life. And he told me some more details about it, that he'd been in Tasmania on a working holiday as a young 22-year-old and had received a telegram and had to rush back to Melbourne and had gone to the hospital and seen her lying with tubes and other things, you know, attached to her in her last hours. And hearing it, it was just really strange because why were they telling me in this way and why now? And who was this person even? And yet then me also trying to grasp that it meant something to him and obviously it was serious.
And was he studying your reaction to this news?
Yeah, because I had been, it turned out the reason they hadn't told me was that I had had periods of depression as a teenager and they were afraid that if I had known that my grandmother had committed suicide, that I might have copycatted her, you know, I would have done the same. The revelation then was that and your great-grandmother committed suicide. So Doris took her life and then Bella took her life and this is something for you to be aware of. And
that you might have this self-destructive gene or something.
Yeah, something pathological. And that was what was so incredible when I read about this culture of suicide as a way for Jewish men and women to make their decision about when they would die, that they wouldn't die under the hands of the Third Reich, that they would do it on the day they did not want to be deported, et cetera, et cetera. So learning about that was fascinating for Doris. Certainly learning about what an incredible life Bella had had and all that she had done. And yes, she had had periods of deep depression, but she was a doer. And then getting to Melbourne, there was nothing to do. And she was, I think, 57 by that stage.
Did your father think of this, her suicide, as a kind of a second abandonment of him?
Absolutely. Yeah, it was shocking. He felt very guilty. He felt he should have loved her more and said more and been more interested in her, as both Ruth and everyone felt like that, three of them, Willie, Ruth and Dad. But he did feel gravely abandoned again because there was a letter for Ruth that Bella had written that Ruth showed him. And so always he said, Bella never wrote anything to me. She never said goodbye.
But was that true?
We thought it was true. I didn't want it to be true. I had various theories. And then in December 2022, 70 years Dad had lived believing that nothing had been left for him. There was somebody at Dad's house. A box was found. In the box, there were many letters. And two of them were from Bella in the 2 weeks before she died, which were effectively goodbye letters, very loving letters to Dad. But he didn't read them until he was well into his 90s. Well, he had read them. He had read them at the time.
What do you mean?
But he couldn't remember them.
What do you mean?
So he was in Tasmania. She wrote him a letter and then another letter to Tasmania, very loving, with a lot of emphasis on saying goodbye, not telling him she was going to commit suicide, but one of them ended, "I love you today, I love you, I'll love you next year and the year after and forever after." And they were goodbye letters, and they were about, "Are you warm enough?" and "I'm so happy for your studies," and "I've put another pair of socks in the post for you because I know that you can get holes in your socks," and "Are the family feeding you enough with all that hiking you're doing? You must be very hungry. And I'm so proud. You've done so well in your studies. I rang Willie today when the letter came with your university results." I mean, we were both crying. He was translating them from the German to the English. There were little bits of English in them as well. I said, "Dad, you read the letters. They've been opened." And he said, "Yeah, I know." He said, "I don't remember them." I think when he received them while he was on holidays, it wouldn't have seemed significant because, of course, his Mutti is there and he'll be seeing her in a few weeks. And I guess the trauma of her suicide just eradicated so much and erased so much, and it just was gone. It was just gone. Even when he read the letters, he couldn't remember reading them at the time. And yet they'd been moved from box to box because it was a 1970s Australia Post box. Maybe if he looked at them again in the 1970s, yet again he didn't remember them. Couldn't comprehend what was being said.
What state were you in after you read those letters?
I was really, really, really profoundly sad for him because this was the goodbye. Even he knew it. And he understood she was being gentle with him in a way that she didn't need to be gentle with his sister.
Where is Bella now? Where is she buried?
She was cremated. There's a little plot for her, which I visited. When my Aunt Ruth was dying, Ruth asked me to go to the gravesite and said no one had ever been. At that point, 50 years had passed. So I said to Ruth, "Yes, I will go and visit." And she said, I feel such a burden of guilt that I let Mutti die. I didn't realise how lonely she was.
So your dad had lived with this story he'd been telling himself all his life. Now that he's read your book, how does he feel about Bella now?
There was a time not that long ago where he definitely felt the burden had lightened. He could see that she had done things that were loving and protective. But in the last couple of years, because his recollection has faded about certain things, he's sort of gotten a bit more resistant. But he definitely has changed his understanding of her. But I think the feeling of abandonment, that will never go.
Does he feel a bit more loved?
Oh, yes. Yeah, he does. I think he feels loved by the process of having his life and his feelings given time and space to talk through.
Isn't your book The Act of a Loving Daughter?
He's very proud of me. He's certainly, but I mean, he's a scientist. They don't go in often necessarily for mushy talk.
Isn't this in some ways the story of how you can get trapped in a story you've told yourself as a kid?
Sure is, yeah. I've really thought a lot about memory, about how you can remember things that don't happen and that really important things that you should remember just are gone. They're just not there. And I guess that's why it's important to talk about history and talk to your family and let people ask questions and sometimes go to feelings that are hard. Otherwise we're stuck. We're always stuck and we hold on. I mean, one of the things that I've learned from doing this book at not just at a personal level but at a political level is that if there is ever to be a peace in the Middle East between the Jews and Palestinians, if there's anything to hope for there, everybody needs to put some of the anger of the past aside and say, how are we going to talk to each other and how are we going to recognise each other's histories as valid and have compassion for each other?
Jane, it's been a completely amazing story. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
podcast and broadcast. You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app.
Today's conversation with Jane Messer was made on the lands of the Gadigal people. Producer was Maggie Morris. The executive producer is Eliza Kirsch. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.